pleasure as president of the Vancouver Institute to welcome you again. We gather for our Saturday night experience, and with a Greek flavor last week and a Roman flavor this week, it's the second half of our classical exposure, at least for this term. Yes, it's classical, but yet somehow relevant to our lives, and I'm delighted to see so many people here tonight for the wonderful presentation that we're going to have. Before we get started, I just wanted to say that over the years, the Institute has been served by outstanding people, and one of them is with us tonight. Please welcome UVC Professor Hector Williams from the Classics Department. Hector? Ladies and gentlemen, our speaker tonight, Dr. Kathleen Coleman, is a world authority who applies her knowledge both in academic endeavors and popular culture. A native of Zimbabwe, it says in the program, South Africa, but she's informed me she's actually from Zimbabwe, so we apologize for that. She received her graduate education at Oxford University, and in 1998, after teaching career in Africa and Ireland, Dr. Coleman became professor of Latin at Harvard University. She's published extensively in areas of Latin literature and history, including the art in the daily life of Romans, some Roman women circa AD 100, animals in the Roman world, and fatal charades, Roman execution stays as mythological enactments. Sounds like an interesting read, Kathleen. Dr. Coleman has also made numerous contributions to the media, including the BBC, National Radio, Public Radio, the Discovery Channel, Granada Television, and the History Channel. And she's also special consultant to Hollywood's DreamWorks Studio in the recent production of the movie Gladiator. Tonight, she will draw on those experiences and her strength as a world-leading authority on Roman gladiators. She's chosen as her title, Virtues of Violence, Gladiators, the Arena, and the Roman System of Values. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Kathleen Coleman.
Thank you so much. Is this microphone now switched off? Thank you very much indeed for that introduction and for inviting me here. It's been an ambition of mine for many decades to see Vancouver, and it's all I had been told it is, but much, much more. It's incomparably beautiful here, and I'm thrilled to be here. So thank you very much for the invitation. Now, it's my job this evening to take you back 2,000 years to the Roman Empire, and to try and give you a sense of why the Romans were very proud of the institution of the amphitheater. And I think that in order to find that out, we need to understand something about what the Roman value system was and how that affected the way they perceived the spectacles of the amphitheater. And to do that, I'm going to look first with you at the sites where these spectacles were performed, and then we're going to look at the spectacles themselves, ask ourselves some questions about the type of people who sponsored gladiatorial combat, the types of persons who performed in gladiatorial combat. We'll look a little bit at the animal displays, the staged beast hunts, and also we'll be looking at public execution in the Roman arena, and try and understand something of why, for the Romans, the institution of the arena was the hallmark of their civilization. Now, on the screen behind you, at least behind me, I beg your pardon, we have on the left-hand side a map of the Roman Empire, and on the right-hand side, a rather dim model of the city of Rome. And because really the Bayerischer Schulatlas is one of the very best atlases of the ancient world, this map is actually in German, but that doesn't matter because what I want you to see is that all the colored part of this map comprises the Roman Empire and Roman amphitheaters or structures adapted for Roman amphitheatrical performance can be found from Britain all the way across the empire into Turkey and beyond. And I say amphitheaters or building adapted for amphitheatrical displays because the Romans, of course, found many theatrical structures when they reached the eastern part of the Mediterranean world, and those structures were consequently adapted for violent displays. So we cannot any longer think that the Greeks were too civilized to be infected by the Roman enthusiasm for violent spectacle, because there's plenty of architectural evidence and other evidence that they adopted these pleasures with enthusiasm. Now, if you look on my model up here, you will see the Colosseum in the top right-hand corner and the Circus Maximus, which of course has a much larger seating capacity, on the bottom of the screen. The Colosseum is not, in fact, one of the best preserved amphitheaters, but it's the one that I'm going to be concentrating on for the first portion of this talk in order to show you what kind of structure the Romans designed in order to accommodate the spectacles that had been growing in popularity since the first gladiatorial combats were performed at Rome in the 3rd century BC as part of funerary celebrations for prominent aristocrats. So we are not going to have a history of gladiatorial combat at Rome, but we are going to leap down 3 centuries to the 1st century AD to see how the Colosseum was created and why. So if I can manage the technology here. Oh. Voila. Thank you very much. Never let it be said that university degrees qualify people to press buttons. You see a romantic view of the Colosseum on the left-hand screen. This is Turner's famous canvas, a very atmospheric, dreamy scene from across the Forum towards the Colosseum. On the right-hand screen, you have a modern view from above the Capitol, and in the distance, you have an equally dreamy view of the Colosseum. There is, of course, absolutely nothing that is dreamy about the Colosseum at all when you consider its function in Roman society. Now, you have a modern denizen of the Colosseum on the left-hand screen, and on the right-hand screen, you have a model of what the Colosseum would have looked like when it was built. Interestingly, it was only in the Flavian era, that is the last quarter of the 1st century AD, that Rome acquired a monumental amphitheater. There was an amphitheater built at Rome something like 50 or 60 years after amphitheaters were first developed in Roman colonies, and that was at the beginning of the reign of Augustus, when one of his generals erected an amphitheater on the Campus Martius, which appears to have been rather small since subsequent emperors preferred to use temporary facilities in other venues rather than stoop to this rather cramped accommodation in Statilius Taurus's amphitheater. But it was the Emperor Vespasian who had, let's face it, usurped power after that power scramble after the death of Nero, who decided to build a major monumental amphitheater in the center of Rome He was very fortunate that there had been a terrible fire under Nero, and that Nero had then sequestered the central portion of Rome for his own palace, the Domus Aurea. Probably this structure was not the selfish seizure of space that the ancient authors depicted it as, because we have evidence that there was public access to portions of Nero's marvelous palace. But at all events, the Flavian dynasty, who were founded by Vespasian, marketed themselves as restoring the center of Rome to the people by building the Colosseum. And this is a phenomenal structure which holds something like 45 or 50,000 people, although the ancient sources tell us that it held 87,000 locca. The trouble is we don't know what a single locus designates in terms of a unit of space. But you have to think of mega thousands of spectators being accommodated in this space. And the beauty of this model, I hope, is that it shows you the tremendous design of this building, which accommodates very easy egress in all of these archways. There are 80 of them around the circumference of the building. And then inside, the sloping stands, the cavea, are supported by a mass of galleries and staircases, which we'll see in cutout in a moment, which allowed the audience to enter at various points within the cavea and go directly to their seating area. And of course, that's a tremendous advantage in a very hierarchical structure like ancient Rome, because it means you don't have any risk of rubbing shoulders with the wrong type of person on the way to your seat. And we might return in due course to this model, but just for the moment, the last thing I'd like you to notice is this ring of masts all the way around the top of the arena, which would have supported the awning. A little bit about that in due course. What I'm hoping that you're going to grasp from this architectural introduction is that the design of the amphitheater was a very tightly articulated design. And I should stress that it had taken nearly two centuries of experimentation to reach the structure of streamlined simplicity that the Colosseum represents. Now, here is a cutaway on this side. And of course, the most important people sit near the front. Guess who has to sit at the back? The women, of course. And on this side, you can see one of the portions of the model with the cutout representing those passageways that support the cavea that I mentioned a moment ago. Now, everybody knows that the Colosseum has got a tremendous basement, something like 6 meters deep, a two-story basement area, which is represented nowadays, because the floor, of course, has not survived down the millennia, is represented by these corridors that you can see in the aerial view on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, on the right-hand screen, you have a diagram showing how the basement area of the Colosseum was designed in order to produce in the arena with maximum efficiency the animals and also scenery that were introduced from underground, from what we call the hypogeum area, the underground, the basement of the arena. And just very simply, the way it would work, if you had a leopard, say, that you wanted to introduce into the arena, he would be driven by flares, slaves carrying flares, into one of these three-sided cages. The metal door, which was attached to the door jambs of this stone wall, would be slammed shut, and then the cage would be elevated to the next level. Here you can see one coming up through its through its channel. And then when the cage got up to the top level, of course, the fourth side was open. And then the beast would be chased along a passageway when it would then meet a ramp and make egress into the arena. This is a very streamlined way of introducing personnel, the actors of the performance, into the arena space. So this is a very sophisticated design. And I know that you want to know about the awning. If you haven't seen the Nova production about it, you may not realize that there's a huge controversy about the way the ceiling was erected to protect the spectators in any theatrical structure, actually, at Rome, from the elements, particularly the sun. And one of the theories is that strips of cloth were unrolled like this. There was always an oculus, an eye in the middle. Over here we have the very famous painting from Pompeii showing the riot in the amphitheater during the reign of Nero. You see all these people rioting like mad in the arena and on the staircases. And what you may be able to see at the top is the furled awning around the tip there. And it looks as though it's on beams which are being angled out over the arena. I'd like to dwell for a moment on this screen because the amphitheater at Pompeii is one of the earliest that was built in the 70s BC, so a good 150 years before the Colosseum was put up in the 70s AD. And you can see instantly what a primitive structure this is. It has the external staircases, and the spectators then have to climb all the way down to their seats once they get into these archways around the top of the arena. Only the very important people can get into the lowest rows of seats from ground level. Everybody else has to queue in a sort of bottleneck on these staircases, of which there are three pairs on the outside of the arena. And I want to emphasize to you what an extremely important development it was to reach a design such as the Colosseum at Rome. I also, of course, want you to think about these arenas being replicated, sometimes in extremely primitive types of structure, throughout the Roman Empire, or in adaptations of pre-existing theatrical or stadium structures in the Greek East. On the pair of screens in front of you now, you have another view of the Colosseum in its rather dilapidated modern state. And on the right-hand screen, you have an extremely unscholarly slide, namely an artist's reconstruction of the Colosseum. A few of the little details, such as these archways around the podium wall, are a little bit suspect. But essentially, I like showing this artist's reconstruction because not only does it help you to visualize the velum, the awning over the arena with its eye, its open space in the center, but also I think it's very, very helpful to see the scenery erected in the center of the arena floor. Because one of the things about these gladiatorial and beast presentations is that they are highly theatricalized. And we know from ancient authors that scenery was introduced into the arena through the trapdoors, quite complicated and elaborate stage sets which could simulate Mount Ida or a river scene. And naturally, if you were having a presentation in the arena using beasts, it would simulate their natural environment. It's much more fun seeing these animals darting around between bushes and so on than just seeing them being chased in an open space. So this taste for verisimilitude is very much part of the appetite that is being fed by these performances. And there, of course, you see the 45,000 people sitting in the stands. However, more important and more convincing than a modern artist's replication of the amphitheater are the Romans' own presentation of the Colosseum on coins. And this, I think, is extremely important to understand that so impressive was the achievement of building the Colosseum that it became a major propaganda message on the coinage of the Flavian emperors. And on the left-hand side here, we have a coin minted in the reign of Titus, the son of Vespasian, whose idea it was to build the Colosseum. It was ultimately dedicated by Titus. And in the coin image, you can see the entire amphitheater, both bird's eye view outside and inside simultaneously by a trick of perspective. And you can see the metasudans, the fountain. There's the water coming out on one side, and a curious double-story structure on the other side, which may have joined the amphitheater to Titus's bath complex next door. And you can see the 45,000 spectators, plus, guess who, in the middle there, isolated by himself in a nice prominent position. That, of course, is the emperor himself, the emperor as a dot. And his box where he sat was, of course, right near the front, because you needed to get the best possible view if you were the most important person there. But the person who has designed the coin on the left-hand screen has elevated the emperor's box so that he is bang in the center of the coin. He's the most important person and has to occupy central position. On the right-hand screen, we have a coin of Gordian III, who was one of those very short-lived emperors in the troubled 3rd century, who had repaired the Colosseum and took the opportunity to put it on one of his coins. But he was even more megalomaniac, it would appear, than Titus. And he, in fact, is the only spectator who has an entire body, not just a dot. And we have two beasts performing in the arena space. The metasudans, the fountain, is there, and behind it, the colossal statue with a radiate crown, which represented the sun. And then the coin legend is very important. It says, Munificentia Gordiani Aug, the munificence of the Emperor Gordian, because the structure was a gift, originally from the Flavian emperors to the people of Rome, and the repair to this structure after major damage in the 3rd century was equally a gift to the people of Rome, restoring to the people of Rome their pleasure dome. And not only a pleasure dome, but a place where they saw Roman values being played out. And the rest of my talk today is going to try and convey to you how that happened. This, I think, is an extremely telling image with that very terse message, the munificence of the Roman emperor. Now, as I mentioned, Vespasian was the emperor who had the idea of building the Colosseum. The Colosseum, of course, is a nickname that the structure acquired in the Middle Ages and is not what the contemporaries would have called it. There was no other amphitheater surviving in Rome when the Colosseum was built, because during Nero's fire, the other amphitheaters that existed by that date were all destroyed. So Vespasian conceived the notion of building the Colosseum. But we've known very little about that process until extremely recently, 6 years ago, in fact, when a German epigrapher, someone who studies the inscriptions of the ancient world, got very interested in a stone that had been lying just inside the entrance to the Colosseum and is replicated in a drawing here on the left-hand screen at the top. This stone has got a rather poorly incised inscription from the late empire, in fact, from the 5th century AD, recording some restorations to the Colosseum. And it occupies two-thirds of the available space. And between the letters of this inscription and beneath them, there are three rows of double holes. Okay? And there you can see these three double rows of holes, which are evidently, originally, held the pegs supporting raised bronze letters of an earlier inscription. And by an extraordinary feat of scholarship, Herr Alfeldi in Heidelberg has managed to decipher what that inscription originally was, partly from tracking the peg holes and partly from his knowledge of what the formulae of inscriptions tends to be. This clearly would have been an original dedicatory inscription that would have been an abbreviated form of the long-winded version of the dedication that would have run around the podium wall around the arena. And this abbreviated version records that the Emperor Vespasian ordered, usit, a new amphitheatre to be built ex manubis out of the spoils of war. And there are some very interesting features about this. I'll talk about three of them with you. The first feature that is interesting is that the amphitheatre is not called the Flavian Amphitheatre. It's simply called the New Amphitheatre. The second interesting feature is that this structure was built out of the spoils of war. At last, if Herr Alfeldi's reconstruction is correct, we have the first definitive proof that the Colosseum was built out of the spoils of the capture of Jerusalem in the Judean campaign, which was fought by Vespasian and Titus. And indeed, it was that campaign that enabled Vespasian to get a large enough military following to be able to capture the purple at Rome and become emperor. And it was the spoils that he captured in the East that enabled him to establish his power in Rome and, in fact, now we know, to build the Colosseum. And it may even be Jewish prisoners of war who were used on the construction, although that has not yet been proved. Interesting that the term he uses there for spoils of war is a very old phrase that died, actually, with the end of the Roman Republic. This is an extremely democratic phrase because manubii are that portion of the spoils of a foreign campaign which are awarded to the general to use for the public good. The general who has been awarded manubii can't go and build himself, you know, a wonderful house by the beach or take himself off to the Bahamas for a holiday or something like that. He has to use that for the public good. And Vespasian is saying, I am an old-fashioned Republican general. I'm a democratic Roman, and I have ordered this amphitheater as my contribution using the spoils of war entrusted to me for the good of the Roman people. But Herr Alfeldi noticed that on the top line, in the left-hand portion of the inscription, there were too many peg holes for the letters that he believed were there in the formula. This is the emperor's formal titulature in abbreviated form, Imperator Caesar Vespasianus Augustus. And Herr Alfeldi discovered that there was a bunching of post holes at the beginning, peg holes at the beginning of the line, which supported an extra letter. And from where you're sitting, you're very well placed, I think, to see that the spacing is much better in the top version of the top line than it is in the lower version of the top line, where we have a nasty bunching of too many letters at the beginning of the line. And that is because Titus inserted his initial between Imperator and Caesar, so that he, in fact, claimed for himself the honor of having dedicated the Colosseum. It is true that Vespasian died in 79, and the great inaugural ceremony in AD 80 was conducted by Titus. But it is also now incontrovertibly the case that we know that Titus, in fact, stole the kudos for the Colosseum from his father. And this, I think, is deeply significant because it demonstrates to us what an enormous propaganda coup it was to be able to claim the Colosseum for oneself. Now, why should it be so important to be able to present the Roman people with the empire's most magnificent amphitheater? I might point out to you, we even have an inscription from somebody who traveled all the way from Bithynia, which was in northern Turkey, to Rome because he wanted to sit in the Colosseum at one of the spectacles in the Colosseum. It would be like going to Rome to see the Pope, equivalent. And I say that meaningfully because I want you to juxtapose those two ideas, going to Rome to watch a bloody gladiatorial combat in the arena, being a lifelong ambition comparable to wanting, if one were a Roman Catholic, to go to Rome to see the Pope. Why should that be? Why should it be such an ambition to sit in those stands, breathe that blood-infected air? Well, maybe part of the answer, and I'm not only showing you these because Professor Williams is an expert on Roman lamps, part of the answer may be recoverable from very ordinary domestic artifacts. Gladiatorial imagery suffuses Roman daily objects. Gladiators were painted on their walls. Gladiators were even stamped on their lamps. Suppose you were Pliny and you were writing letters deep into the night and your lamp gave out. When you called for another lamp, would you say, Narcissus, bring me my gladiatorial lamp? Or didn't the imagery matter? I don't know. But did they care about what was on their lamps? Why is it that we have a large repertoire of lamps that show us gladiators in combat? Why is it that we have lamps which show gladiatorial equipment around the discus? Greaves, helmet, shield, and sword. I'm so pleased to have been to your magnificent Museum of Anthropology on Friday afternoon because I discovered in one of those drawers in the ancient section that you have one of these lamps with gladiatorial equipment depicted on it. It's a terracotta and very well worth seeing. It's the lowest drawer in the middle rank if you want to go and have a look at it. Now, the gladiators. These people who were common or garden design features in the Roman household. Who were they really? Well, they were persons who were either slaves and therefore chattels who could be required to perform various tasks for their masters. And if the master was a gladiatorial trainer, then they were obliged to be trained as gladiators if they had the suitable physique. Or they could be freeborn persons who chose to fight as gladiators. And this may seem a tremendous paradox to us because it seems a most unlikely wish to have to want to fight as a gladiator, and there are reasons for it. When such a person chose to effectively sell himself into the gladiatorial career, he got a down payment straight away, so there was a financial incentive. And he got that payment in return for taking an oath. And that oath effectively reduced him to the status of a slave because he swore, as you see on the left-hand screen, to be branded, fettered, flogged, and killed with an iron weapon should it be necessary. And this, of course, to aristocratic Romans seemed to be a very non-you kind of thing to do, in that they were surrendering their status as freeborn Romans. So the part of the paradox of the Roman gladiator is that he's a person who is despised for the surrender of his freedom But he's also a person who is greatly admired for the manly virtue that he displays in his mastery of gladiatorial technique. And you need to appreciate how incredibly detailed gladiatorial fighting styles were. On the discus of that lamp on that side, I showed you very briefly a range of gladiatorial equipment. Equipment was matched to fighting style, and there was an enormous range of fighting styles. If you could fight in more than one style, you put it on your epitaph. It was like being able to do MS Word and another type of computer skill. I can only do MS Word, so I can't even imagine being able to do more than one. And gladiators were trained to fight in a particular style, and the important gladiatorial training schools in a city like Rome would have had dedicated trainers who were versed in one specific style. You know, if you want to learn flute, you don't go to a generalist, someone who also has to be able to teach piano and viola and trumpet and so on. You go to a flute teacher, and if you've got any ambition. And the gladiatorial trainers are recorded in inscriptions as being dedicated to one fighting style. And if you had trained against a beach umbrella stand, which is exactly what this looks like, it is the palus, the training post. Here's a gladiator in training fighting with his sword thrusts against this post in preparation for the real thing. And if you had trained to be able to fight with two sets of weapons in two sets of styles, then that went on your epitaph. I imagine that the ordinary spectator sitting in the stands would have been absolutely expert in the different fighting styles and be able to appreciate the thrusts and parries and other gestures and techniques that every gladiator performed, so that they were sure, they were hoping, let's be honest, they were hoping for blood and injury, but they were also hoping for expert fighting styles. And this is no doubt why gladiators appeared in public so infrequently. They practiced maybe for 6 months for one public appearance, contrary to popular belief. Now, another reason that we know that there were huge gladiatorial followings among the general public is because from Pompeii we have a whole sequence of graffiti. Thank goodness. People waiting for the equivalent of the Pompeian bus outside one of the gates of Pompeii would have scribbled away on the walls of the local tombs while they were waiting. And they incised with the sharp tip of their stylus such creations as the one you see on the left-hand screen, where we have a cartoon scene of two gladiators with accompanying text. And the two involved here are named for us Marcus Atilius and Lucius Raecius Felix. Very interesting that certainly Raecius was a freeborn Roman. He's got the tria nomina of the freeborn Roman, and it looks as though Marcus Atilius was also freeborn. So these were both auctorati. These were gladiators who had taken that oath and sworn allegiance to their trainer. And we have the score being kept. This is extremely important. It shows you that the gladiatorial following didn't only appreciate the spectacle of the professionalism of the fight, but they also kept a very close tally of how the gladiators were shaping up. And Marcus Atilius has won one crown. That's the one at the end with that back to front C, and he has won this engagement. And the one in front of the crown tally presumably represents the numbers of times that he has appeared before or has won before. And he has been victorious over Lucius Raecius Felix, who has fought or won 12 times before, had a crown every time. See the back to front C in the numeral. And this time he is M for Missus. He has been awarded missio, in other words, a reprieve. Presumably he fought well enough not to lose his life after this ignominious defeat. We know also that he has been granted or has appealed for missio because he's taken his helmet off. There's his helmet. It's the right way up, so it can't have fallen off. He must have taken it off and put it on the ground as a symbol of his surrender to his opponent. And on the right-hand screen, you have the only surviving depiction of female gladiators from the Roman world. And these two ladies come from Halicarnassus in modern Turkey. And their names are inscribed in Greek on the plinth they're standing on, Amazon and Achillea, the feminine form of the name Achilles. That's a good stage name for a lady gladiator. And so is Amazon, obviously. And above in Greek, it tells us, Apeluthesan, it tells us that they were granted a reprieve. They had fought to a draw. You will notice that their helmets are not on their heads, but I suggest to you that that's what these objects are here on either side of the plinth. They have been removed and are symbolically flanking the plinth on which their owners are standing because they are a symbol of the gladiators' recognition that they are not able to win a victory one over the other. So they've taken off their helmets to symbolize that they reached a draw. Would that we knew more about the training and origins of these two women. Unfortunately, we don't. But the fact that they were being trained and fighting in the Greek East in the 2nd or 3rd century AD is an indication of how the sponsors of the arena spectacles were constantly looking for novelty. And that's a very prominent trend in the repertoire of the arena. Always the sponsors were looking to better the previous sponsors. Now, gladiators, as I've already indicated, could win crowns for their performance if they'd fought exceptionally well. And here we have a gladiator's tombstone from Pergamum in Turkey, and it's now in the museum in Berlin. And you will see that this gladiator had won 4 crowns in his career. There's no way that those are just decorations filling the blank field behind the relief sculpture of the gladiator, because if that were the case, we would have another one filling the vacant space at the bottom. So this is a record of the actual tally of crowns, the number of honorary degrees that he'd been awarded in his lifetime. And on the right-hand screen, you have an epitaph recording the death of a gladiator, Nacedo, who was a gladiator of the Thracian style. He came from Alexandria. And this monument was put up for him by his fellow gladiators. Notice that they're all in the same fighting style. So that's his troop. He was only 20 when he died. And the inscription there gives us a sense of the camaraderie among the gladiators in that they had clubbed together and maybe they were, in fact, paying into a funerary fund, and they put up this monument to their fellow gladiator. Now, we have a very detailed record of the progress of some gladiators' fights on Roman mosaics, of which I give you a pair here. The way to read these is from what would face you when you entered the room and saw the floor to the back of the room. So you read them from the bottom register to the upper register, not the other way around, because you start with what will be in front of you when you enter. And we see on the left-hand screen Astyanax and Calendio fighting it out. Calendio is the retiarius type who fights with a trident and a net and is very vulnerable because he has no heavy armor. He fights against a heavily armed gladiator over whom he's managed to cast his net. So this is very exciting. It looks as though Calendio, the retiarius, is about to win. Notice his sole piece of protective equipment is the galerus, the shoulder guard, on his left shoulder. So he's coming in for the thrust with his trident, but if you read the top register, you'll see, amazingly, Astyanax has managed to win, because there's Calendio on the ground, and Astyanax has wicket, has won, and Calendio, with the Theta Nigrum next to his name, has in fact died, clearly not in the engagement, because he's very much alive there, but he has lost his life afterwards, because it was deemed he had not fought well enough. And so exciting was this encounter that it deserved commemoration in mosaic. It's extremely important to understand that the sponsors who shelled out for these performances were actually doing a kind of potlatch, in a sense, because this was so much of an ephemeral moment of glory, an amphitheater performance. And therefore, commemoration in a durable form is very much part of the evidence for the sponsor's ambition to be remembered in perpetuity for this magnificent display. And on the right-hand side, you see two gladiators fighting together. Again, we've got their names, Maternus and Habilis. And you have the referee and his second on either side of them, and then the referee at the top with his long wand, and we'll see that Habilis is the winner, and Maternus, who's flat on his tum in this half of the slide, has lost. That's what the Theta Nigrum is doing. It's important to understand that these were very professional fights which were presided over by a team of referees. And I'm sure that there would have been marks in the sand, and, you know, you can't put your left foot over that line and your right foot has to be behind this line and all the rest of it. And we've lost all that, of course, from the record. But this is not just a free-for-all. Now, of course, one of the extraordinary things about the Romans is that they were able to be sentimental about areas of life that we regard as hardly fodder for a sentimental or whimsical attitude. And I suggest to you that they could be very sentimental about gladiatorial combat, to the extent of imagining cutesy little cupids dressed up as gladiators. As you can see on the gladiatorial frieze, which is at the bottom of this apse in a villa at Bignor in England. And what I'm going to show you in close-up is, of course, this portion at the bottom here. We have incontrovertibly a gladiatorial scene, but these little gladiators are chubby little cupids, and the mosaic artist has managed to insert their wings despite all this armor, and their armor is looking pretty reluctant. If you look at the expression on that one's face, he doesn't look too keen, and the referee is bossing him up. This is a miniature little retiarius with his trident and his net, and there is the heavily armed gladiator who presumably is going to have to fight. And it seems extraordinary, at least to me and probably to you, that the Romans could be so whimsical about something as brutal as gladiatorial combat. But I think that the very fact that they could present us with an image like this gives us some sense that to them, gladiatorial combat was nothing to be ashamed of or frightened of, and that it was something to be indulgently proud of, which is a fairly horrifying thought. You don't think, of course, that gladiatorial combat is the only thing that went on in the ancient arena, so I'm going to give you a couple of images of venationes, staged hunts, with professional beast fighters. Very frequently, persons from the native territory of the beasts who knew how to fight them in their natural habitat. And on the left-hand screen, you've got a Campana plaque showing how very frank the Romans were in the depiction of the kind of encounter you might expect of this nature. We have one bestiarius, that is to say a professional beast fighter, who is being mauled by a lion. You have another one getting the better of a bear, and a second feline is downing the bestiarius on the left, and there are enthusiastic spectators in that spectator building in the background. On the right-hand screen, this is a very interesting mosaic. We have an overall design as you walk around this floor. One of the pairs of bestiarius and leopard is going to be the right way up, wherever you stand on this floor. But you need to stand the way you are sitting in order to be able to read this very detailed inscription, which occupies the central portion of the mosaic. And in summary, what we have here is a celebration of a particular performance sponsored by somebody called Megarius. And this mosaic comes from a tiny little place in Tunisia called Smirat. So small is it that we don't even know what it was called in antiquity. And it certainly had no amphitheater. The nearest amphitheater would have been miles and miles away, probably the one at El Djem, ancient Tisdras. And what we have to assume, I think, is that Megarius had sponsored a spectacle in one of those amphitheaters in Tunisia that he then wanted recorded permanently on his villa floor to impress his clients and associates. And what he particularly wanted to impress them with was his munificence. And this inscription says, it records the announcement by the herald asking the spectators how much they think each of these leopards was worth. Notice that they are bleeding copiously. They also are named, which is really weird, that each of these animals who's going to be hunted in the arena is so well known to the team which has captured and nurtured them that they've even named them. And each of them, of course, is being worsted by his human opponent. And the spectators are asked how much they think Megarius should pay. And they say in the inscription, 500 denarii per leopard. Jolly good. And then we hear at the end of the inscription that, of course, Megarius has bettered that, because on each of these money bags, there's the 8 on its side, which to us represents infinity, but to the Romans represented the numeral 1,000. So that Megarius has doubled the price. Now that is generosity. As the inscription says, that's what it means to be generous. That's what it means to produce a set of games. This is somebody who has recorded his munificence and also the brutality of the spectacle in permanent stone form on his floor. The ubiquity of gladiatorial imagery even reaches the balustrades of Greek theatres in the Roman East. On this side is a little balustrade from the Greek theatre at Miletus, which was revamped by the Romans so that they could show gladiatorial and other arena spectacles. And one of the little pieces of sculpture shows you one of these cutesy Cupid bestiarii poking a sharp implement into the hindquarters of some rather anonymous-looking species. And on the right-hand side, we have another lamp, which shows a bestiarius in combat with a very shaggy bear. So these are everyday objects. You would rest your arm on that balustrade, you would light that lamp, and you would have the arena suffusing your life. However, there is a third category of spectacle that I want to deal with, which is the use of the arena for public execution. Now, it's very important to bear in mind this social hierarchy which controlled the Roman world. I mentioned at the beginning how people sat in a stratified way so that you had the satisfaction of seeing every category of citizen in his proper place, with the important ones in the places where they could see best and be seen, of course. Now, gladiators were despised for their surrender of social status or their lack of it in the first instance. And the persons who could be executed in the arena were also completely worthless and dispensable because they were non-citizens, barbarians, who had infringed the canons of behavior by challenging the legal order at Rome and could then be disposed of in spectacular ways. On the left-hand screen, you have a relief from the Greek East, from Miletus, which shows you a prison warder with a long staff who is leading a sequence of prisoners who are shackled together, you will notice, around the neck. And the leading one is holding a placard, which would no doubt give the names and offenses of the prisoners who are being led off to execution. This thong around the leading prisoner's wrist is being dragged along by the warder. On the right-hand screen, you have a scene from the column of Marcus Aurelius, the philosopher emperor, the emperor who tells us in his meditations that he didn't like the arena because it was not cruel, not disgusting, not offensive, but boring. And he knew that despite his Stoic ideals, the empire ran on force. And on his column, he had depicted with gruesome realism the decapitation of barbarian prisoners. And here is one who's already been severed at the neck. There's his head lying there. And here's one who's waiting literally for the chop from the executioner. Now, execution is fine and can be done in various ways, and it's always done in public in the Roman world because you want to give the population the satisfaction and reassurance of knowing that justice has been done and these miscreants have been disposed of. And, of course, the arena is a very good place for doing that, especially when you want to do it in an extremely dramatic manner, which requires a very sophisticated infrastructure. And I'm thinking here of the aggravated death penalties, of which the most obvious for the purposes of the arena is the condemnation to the beasts. But crucifixion and also burning alive fall into this category also. And sometimes you can get quite imaginative combinations of penalties. Sometimes people being crucified and burnt simultaneously, that kind of thing. And from Tunisia, we have a very interesting mosaic from a domestic dwelling in a city, so from an ordinary Roman domus, where in one of the public rooms we have this extraordinary image of a structure in the center surrounded by scenes of damnatio ad bestias, with prisoners being propelled by attendants towards beasts, which are already mauling them. And you have on this side a close-up of the bottom left-hand corner on the left-hand screen, where we have the outline of the attendant, but the tesserae, the little mosaic pieces, have been lost from his body. That's why he's just brown. And he, notice, has got sandals on and is propelling this prisoner, no sandals, naked, in fact, except for this little loincloth, this subligaculum, is being propelled towards the beast, which has already pounced on top of him. This is a leopard. And you will notice the graphic realism with which the Roman artist depicts the bleeding at every point of contact between bestial tooth or claw and human flesh. Seems quite inconceivable to us, I think, that one might decorate one of the major reception rooms of one's house with such an image. Presumably, it is meant to record a spectacle that was actually sponsored by the owner of the dwelling. We can't be sure of that, but it seems a likely hypothesis. And the fact that such an image is suitable for a private dwelling rests upon the belief that this person deserved to suffer in the manner of his death. There was a dual penalty system that developed at Rome whereby if you were a Roman citizen, you would not be subject to as violent penalties as if you were not. And such a person as this was clearly not a citizen. He was dispensable. It's what I call the apartheid mentality in the Roman world. He deserves to die, and by his death, he actually performs finally a service to the Roman people because he entertains them by the manner of his dying. Now, just a couple of final images to bring the point home. This is a dinner plate. North African terracotta. And when you finally got through your chickpeas, you would be rewarded with the scene of this prisoner attached to this upright and a lion on the other side. On the right-hand screen, a very, very interesting image from Cyllene in Libya showing a bull with his belly band, which may be meant to constrict his belly and perhaps, in fact, anger him by pressing on the scrotum. And he is apparently tossing these figures, or if you look at them with another kind of perspective, they may already be lying crumpled on the ground, depending on the way you read this. But it's quite clear that an attendant is propelling this pajamaed prisoner towards the bull so that this guy will end up like those guys. And in the background, we've got the person who is sort of orchestrating the whole spectacle, and a very interesting inscription, Philo Serapis Comp, short for Composuit, which either means I, Philo Serapis, or at least he, Philo Serapis, composed the image. This is the characteristic way that a mosaicist would sign an image in the third person. Philo Serapis did this one. In other words, this is my chef d'oeuvre, this is my Renoir, or it might mean that Philo Serapis put on this display. In other words, the name is the name of the sponsor who composed the spectacle. Whether it's the sponsor or the artist, I think it's extremely significant that an image like this is signed because it shows that the arena could be exploited at every level for personal gain. It is a nexus of Roman values which can refract glory upon the people who perform, the people who make the performance possible, and the people who record it. My very last sequence of all gives you in registers on the left-hand screen a very famous mosaic, also from Libya, which shows an entire amphitheater performance. It's around the perimeter of a room, and I've put it in registers. This is only part of the entire whole, so that you can see the spectacle right from the musicians to the condemnation to the beasts. Yes, there was a band playing in the arena, and usually a woman was playing the water organ, as here. The eyes of the musicians are all turned in the same direction towards this sequence here, where the referee is clearly presiding over the finale of the combat, where this gladiator has managed to down his opponent. So, in other words, the band played when it was really exciting. Not like a modern bullfight when the band stops playing at the moment when the matador finally spikes the bull, but in the arena, that's when the band did play. Now, I have to be really clever because that screen is not the knob I would expect. It's this one. Right. Now, here we've got this sequence here, where you can see a wonderful variation on Damnatio et Bestia. Somebody had the bright idea of making little miniature chariots with a long kind of sort of wheelbarrow-type handle so that you could tie a prisoner to an upright on this wheeled device and then the attendant at arm's length or at wheelbarrow's handle's length could propel the prisoner towards the beast. And you see what happens when the beast gets the idea that the prisoner's meant for him. And then we also have this Roman taste for seeing which of an unequally matched pair will win. You have the very heavy bull against the lighter, more nimble bear, just the same way that you have the lightly armed and very mobile retiarius, but vulnerable, fighting the heavily armed but rather static heavily armed gladiator like a secutor. And here the attendant is jerking the chain that chains these beasts together in order to arouse them. And finally, a gruesome one to leave you with, but we have here an attendant who is, in South African terms, shambucking a prisoner towards this lion. That's just a piece of damage on the mosaic up there. And this gesture of horror that the prisoner is showing as he tries to ward off that beast, I think is a cry, a cri de coeur across the centuries to us. But remember that it's being depicted from the Roman perspective. So that's what you delight in, seeing a prisoner horrified by his fate. It's a fate he deserves. And the arena is the locus where all these values are played out, and where from the Roman point of view, Mr. Average, what is being done there is proof that we control both nature in the form of these beasts and also the subject peoples of the empire. There were, of course, dissenting voices. There was Marcus Aurelius, who was bored by it all, and there were other people who claimed that it was offensive behavior, in the sense that it was the amphitheater was a place where you would lose your self-control. That's what the Christian fathers say about it. They say it's a horrible pagan practice. You shouldn't go there. You should come to church instead. And if you go there, you'll lose your sense of free will. You'll become infected by the passions of the arena. The kinds of criticisms of the Roman arena that we hear uttered by Romans are hardly ever humanitarian criticisms. That was not questioned by the Romans. You may want to question it, and I now ask you to ask me some questions, and I'll try and answer them. Thank you. Yes. Right. The question is about those 45,000 people who were spectators in the Colosseum and how this played out over the centuries. Well, we know that gladiatorial combat ultimately died out in Rome in the 5th century. Gladiatorial combat did not cease with the Christianization of the Roman Empire. Constantine uttered that famous edict saying the shedding of blood in times of peace does not please us. And yet, there's plenty of evidence from inscriptions, from texts, from images that gladiatorial combat continued in the Roman world for another century, but much more in the West than in the East. It was extremely expensive. That's the first point. And when you consider that there is an illustration in a legal text that claims, if you want to understand how a purchase, you have to think, rent a gladiator, return him to his barracks, pay 1% of what you pay if he's killed. Then you understand that these gladiators were a very expensive investment, and that meant that if you could afford to dispatch a gladiator, in your games. You were demonstrating your tremendous wealth. Because they got so expensive, may have been one reason why ultimately they died out. More interesting in a way is why they didn't die out sooner. Why did they carry on in the West when they started to die out in the East? You couldn't even find people in the East to take public office because they knew that as part of their public office they would have to put on these games, and they were so expensive and there was no subvention and it was just eating away their patrimony. But in the Roman West they carried on longer, and it may have partly been because aristocrats used gladiators as personal bodyguards, trained gladiators, and that apparently was one of the influences that may have kept them going in the West. But there's definitely a shift in taste, and what takes over is, of course, in the Greek East, the chariot racing, and throughout the rest of the empire, the beast hunts, which continue for at least another century. You're welcome. There and then there, I think.
Do any of our modern spectator sports trace their ancestry back to the gladiatorial contest?
Interesting question. Do any of our modern spectator sports trace their ancestry back to these kinds of spectacles? Well, I think that the impetuses are often the same. Delight in sort of the competitive spirit and the professionalism, that's obviously at play in all kinds of arenas like wrestling and so on. The one spectator sport that seems to be most akin to the Roman arena is, of course, Spanish bullfighting. Although, to my knowledge, there's no direct link that we're able to trace. We've just lost centuries of evidence between the late Roman world and the, well, really the Renaissance history of Spain. But certainly these instincts and this kind of schadenfreude as well, which you see in the arena, delighting in the suffering of others. And here I'm thinking not so much about gladiators, but actually about the executions in the arena. That is an instinct that I think is actually not very deep below the surface in most of us. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's worth studying the Roman arena, because it should make us stop and consider that we are finding reprehensible today what the Romans were so proud of 2,000 years ago. If there were public executions in downtown Vancouver, I bet you wouldn't get a seat. And I also think that in 2,000 years' time, there will be things in our culture that people will find reprehensible that we regard as some of our most civilized techniques. What about euthanasia? Yes.
I have two questions.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, that there is evidence.
This summer I went to a place called Vienne, which has got a lot of Roman temples, amphitheater, and any number of mosaics. Mm-hmm. It was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, absolutely. Yes, indeed, Vienne certainly was an important site, and throughout Roman Gaul and all the northern provinces, we have very interesting evidence, in fact, for locations on that perimeter of Roman power where you sometimes had pairs of amphitheaters. I'm thinking of Carnuntum, which is south of Vienna, east of Vienna on the Danube, downstream from Vienna, and also Xanten, which is on the River Rhine, just inside Germany today, where you have an amphitheater for the civilian population and another one for the military camp. There's another example at Budapest where there are two amphitheaters. And this is particularly interesting because it shows us this militant link between gladiatorial combat and military combat. And obviously, there's a very close overlap. We know that right from the 2nd century BC, gladiatorial trainers were drafted in to help the army improve its fighting techniques. And it's also, of course, a way of helping those fringe legionary settlements on the borders of the empire to feel that they belong. There's this nice Roman spectacle going on which raises their morale and cows the locals. So that obviously Vienne is much further inside the empire and doesn't quite fall into that category. But nevertheless, a sign of being Roman was having the facilities, as sophisticated as possible, to be able to perform these Roman spectacles. Yes?
What form of booty or plunder would they transport back, would they, from Jerusalem? What would be the object of
the... What was the plunder that the Romans brought back from Jerusalem? Well, we've got very detailed accounts of it, actually. Accounts from the Dead Sea Scrolls of what they hid away from the Romans, and accounts in Josephus of what they brought back. And it was largely precious metals and objects in precious metals, like candelabras and gold objects, ingots. Enormous wealth came back. And some of it is depicted inside the Arch of Titus, which faces the Colosseum in Rome. Yes?
Would you care to comment on what liberties were taken with historical fact in the recent movie?
Oh, enormous liberties were taken, obviously. And they did not put a disclaimer at the beginning or end of the film saying, you know, this is actually not historically accurate. When you think about it, a number of works of really important literary merit have involved modern, at least historical characters in a fictitious setting. So that's got quite a respectable pedigree. The kinds of errors that I think in the film are more egregious than that were what I might call atmospheric errors, errors of things like costuming, which give one the completely wrong impression about how a Roman matrona would be dressed. She would never wear a diaphanous garment, you know, off the shoulders and this sort of sexy hairstyle going down her back. You know, no, absolutely not. And we have filled, all our museums are filled with Roman statuary. You only have to walk into your own museums here to see what the Romans wanted us to remember them looking like. And yet it was Alma Tadema's paintings which were of greater influence with Hollywood than the proper record that they could have used. And putting, you know, inscriptions on the buildings that weren't in proper Latin, things like that, those are also, I think, obviously an indication that people don't mind about that kind of thing, or they think that people aren't going to mind. It's also a kind of insult, I think, to the Romans. But actually, you'd better not get me on this topic. And I loved the scriptwriter. He was super. Yes.
My question is, the amphitheater was a place of public spectacle in Roman era. Today, the spectacle seems to come right into our living room.
Yeah.
What is the relationship between modern media and the role of the amphitheater in the Roman times?
That's a very interesting question. What is the relationship between the role of modern media and the Roman arena? It is true, obviously, that our media can invade our private space to a much greater extent than violence in, staged violence could invade the homes of ancient Romans. But it makes me think of two things. One is that the concept of privacy, as we understand it today, was completely foreign and unknown to the Romans. And the whole notion of private space was something that we just have to shed from our consciousness when we look at the Roman house, which was a public space in a sense that's quite inconceivable today. You would have virtual strangers coming right into the sort of inner sanctums of your house to build up business relationships and for reasons of showing a kind of privileged relationship with the homeowner. When I showed you the bull up on the right-hand screen, I should have pointed out that that's in a cubiculum, a tiny little private space for reclining. And it's so angled that you've actually got the image facing the couch, so that when you took your favorite client into this cubiculum to recline on the couch and strike a business deal, this guy would be lying there looking at this thing on the floor thinking, you know, this chap is obviously tougher than I had realized. So that in a sense, those images, those mosaic images, are the ancient media bringing this repertoire of violence into the Roman home. And the other thing to remember is that the Romans lived much more publicly than we do, in the sense that they lived out on the street, and they had much more sort of social interaction in the public sphere. And getting a seat in the Colosseum was something that people would queue for hours, it would appear, because we actually have some of those posts, those stone posts, still remaining around the perimeter of the Colosseum Piazza, which would have been used for holding the cables that would have kept crowd control organized. So that, yes, I do think that there is a relationship between the way the modern media publicized this, but it was publicized in antiquity just on coinage. The ancient Romans would have looked at coins with far more attention than we do. Can you tell us what's on your quarter coin? You probably can't remember what those images are. But in an illiterate society, those kinds of images are much more potent. So, yeah, I think the Roman arena was dispersed by the ancient equivalent of our media. Yes. Yeah, a very good question. Were they betting on the outcome of the gladiatorial combats? Probably. In fact, almost certainly, I would say, although there's very little hard evidence for this. But Ovid talks about going to watch gladiators and asking to share his girlfriend's program, which seems to sort of... Well, it's actually not a girlfriend. He's trying to make a pickup in the arena. And he... ask this girl if he can read her program. And it seems to be perhaps a list of gladiatorial form which would enable people to make bets on the outcome. Because they bet furiously at the circus, the chances of them not betting on gladiators, I think, are pretty remote. Yes? Yes, Seneca does say quite a bit about the Roman arena, and he concedes that some of these people are very sort of low-grade, unimportant people. But what he specially objects to is that when you go to the arena, you are losing that sense of discrimination and control, and you get infected by the passions of the people who are sharing the space with you. And in one place he says, when you go, I think actually to the theater, but that's a word that is sometimes used to encompass other types of spectacle as well, the time to get out is before they start distributing the freebies to the crowd. So, you know, he's saying you can actually go and watch the spectacle, but you have to get out before you might be trampled by the excitement of spectators leaping to catch these presents and so on. And St. Augustine is very famous, obviously, for the anecdote about his friend Alypius, who wouldn't go to the arena until finally he was taken to the Colosseum, and then he got drunk on the sight of blood, and he lost his self-control, and then he became an addict of the arena. So I don't want to overplay this. It is true that they did object, both Seneca and Augustine, to the shedding of blood and the cruelty, but they were especially concerned with the fact that you no longer were able to discriminate and you got sucked into this sort of hype, and that was very distressing. Yes, there's a question in the second rank at the top there. There's nothing that I have come across that is quite comparable to the Roman arena. Obviously, human sacrifice in some of the cultures of Central and South America in some ways have resonances that are similar to the arena. But I think the orchestration of these events in a competitive spirit, not always resulting in death, but involving a very highly trained set of combatants and various odds being balanced on either side, as a regular form of public amusement, is something that is unique to the Romans.
Why might that be?
Well, I think partly it's because they are a militaristic society, and you have to remember that by the end of the Republic, most wars were only ever fought on the perimeter of the empire. So this sort of militaristic spirit was really kept alive empire-wide by these spectacles in the arena with fully armed, fully equipped fighters. And I also think it has something to do with being able to do it. The Romans had the technology to do this. And that's why I spent so long at the beginning showing you the architecture of the Colosseum, because I think that's a very telling aspect of why they set such store by their arena spectacles. They could do it. They had the technology to make it all more and more and more inventive. And that was also part of the way they were presenting themselves to their subject peoples. Yes? Up there? Okay, how does the violence of the Roman arena play against the way they conducted their private lives? Well, there are two ways of looking at this. One is to say that all of this violence was cathartic, and the Romans had had a wonderful hype when they went to the arena, and then they went sort of sedately home and were good as gold when they got there. And the other way to look at it is to say that the Romans got so hyped up by all of this that they raced out of the arena into the nearest brothel to lay the nearest prostitute, and then they went home and beat their wives up. And we don't have any evidence either way, actually. The Roman woman was much more emancipated than probably most people think. And maybe we would have some sense if there were a tremendous degree of brutality in the Roman household. Obviously, the Roman paterfamilias had the right of, life and death, really, over the members of his household. He could inflict corporal punishment on his children. But I think one very interesting aspect of this, which is sort of latent behind your question, is the extent to which children are educated in the values of the arena. And that does reflect the way this public violence is played out in what we would think of as a very private sphere. And what I'm thinking about especially here is not just pedagogy taking their charges to the arena. In the Colosseum, there was a special portion of seating for young boys and another set of seating for their pedagogy, for their nurses, the males who took them around the city and looked after them. So they were supposed to be there, they were supposed to be imbibing the values of the arena and all the rest of it. But also, children were encouraged in sports like cockfighting and that kind of thing. We think that, you know, keeping pets is very good for children because they learn a sense of responsibility. They feed the animal and they keep its cage clean and they empty its litter tray and all the rest of it. And when it dies, they have to, you know, go through the grieving process and getting used to the specter of death and all the rest of it. But the way the Roman child kept pets was in a much more combative and sort of conflictual and competitive spirit. So that I think, is also a way in which the arena kind of reflects, it is reflected in something as apparently unrelated as the upbringing of children. Yes? Yes, sure. This was a multi-million dollar industry. Let's just take, for example, the importing of wild beasts from North Africa to the arena. They came from all over the empire. Just let's deal with North Africa. We've got a lot of evidence from mosaics of the way these beasts were trapped. They had, obviously, to not be injured, because they would be useless if they were injured, and totally useless if they were killed. So they get trapped by netting, usually, and then they have to be transported in carts all the way to the shore, to the port, and then they have to be put on a ship, and they have to be shipped across to Italy or wherever in the empire they're being taken. They have to be fed, they have to be looked after. It takes a huge amount of expertise just to know what these things eat, and provide the right sort of leaves for the rhinoceros and all the rest of it. And then they have to be dealt with when they get to Italy. We have those huge beast pens outside the Porta Prenestina in Rome for actually corralling the animals. There were copious laws in the digest of Justinian limiting what sort of animals you will allow in a city, in a built-up area, because sometimes these things get out and then they eat the wrong person and, you know, so on and so forth. And so the way it kind of played out in the economic and legal sphere is incredibly complex. And the economics of it have not really been properly assessed because we lack evidence. But one area that has been dealt with in detail by a modern economic historian of ancient Rome is the finances of building amphitheaters. And by far the most expensive structure you could put up in any Roman settlement, any Roman community, was an amphitheater, much, much more expensive than a temple or a theater or any other thing. And every place of any pretension had to have one, or had to convert some other building so that they could accommodate these spectacles. And then you had to keep it up, which is why we have all these magnificent inscriptions from around the empire saying that I, the daughter of such and such a family of my city, whose great-great-grandfather built the first theater and great-grandfather built the first amphitheater, I restored the amphitheater when it was crumbling, or I restored the baths when they were crumbling, or whatever it was. It was part of the civic duty of the local magnates to keep the whole system in operation. And that was obviously a huge drain on private fortunes, but simultaneously it was an outlet for the pride and status of these people. For actually performing the spectacles themselves, we know that in the colonial charters of the Roman Empire, there were built-in subventions for these public spectacles, so that it was a dollar-for-dollar thing. If the sponsor put in a dollar, the town put in a dollar. And often on inscriptions, you will see somebody saying, I put on this spectacle out of my own money, which means I actually said, no, I won't use the subvention. I'll do it myself. And that is an outlet for their wealth, but it's also obviously a financial drain on the system because they could have been spending that money on, you know, feeding schemes for the poor because those existed as well. But the proper economics of this have not really been studied yet.